Session number 14974, Paul Armstrong, Reel 2.
Mr. Paul Armstrong, Reel 2. You would have a uniform in the Scouts, Mr. Armstrong. What was it like? What exactly was it?
It was... Oh, you people probably don't know, but it was the hat, which I think attracted most of our attention, because it reminded us of the picture of cowboys that one had seen in Boy's Own Paper. And... It was khaki in colour and identical to that one saw of the mounted police. The shirt was khaki and had a lanyard, a tie, fastened with, one will always remember, a toggle. And the different troops had different colours of tie. The shorts were khaki and I may say that boys until the age of at least 14 and generally older wore short trousers, so shorts weren't at all surprising to us. And then we had knitted long stockings to the knees and footwear I can't even remember. We also had our scout staff. This was a 6 foot pole and it was very, very popular. I remember the most unusual use I saw it put to was when one of my younger brothers inserted very carefully a double-edged razor blade, lashed a chip pan to the end and passed it over a fence where he'd been told not to go into a garden and sawed away the stalk of an apple to drop it into his... He didn't trespass, but he got his apple. The scoutmaster was actually, I learned later, an accountant, Bert Lodes, a very good living man and very good to the boys. He devoted a lot of time to his scouts. And our troop leader was a boy who'd injured his foot, his ankle, childhood, and although he's crippled with it, it never deterred him from doing absolutely anything. Neville Elcote, and he really was very, very strong on discipline, hard work, and patriotism.
How were you disciplined?
Mainly by a very, very sharp word. There were no actual punishments except that one was sometimes given the harder jobs when we went to the weekend camps. But punishment was mainly the harsh word. One had felt one let the side down and it rankled.
There was a great deal of inter-troop rivalry within your own unit.
I can't remember a lot of that because we strove against each other. It was one of those things where one was trying all the time to outdo the man next to you. So that when it came to other troop meeting with other troops, you generally felt you were going to show as a troop that you were far superior to anyone else. And what you did was what mattered. What they did didn't really count. Interesting.
How do you take to discipline personally?
I expected it because my father had been in the Territorial Army when he was young and he wasn't allowed to go abroad because of the family and his job with the building locomotive, well, I don't know what they were building for the war. I was too young to realise. But for the war work they were doing in 1418, two of his brothers had served during the Great War, both in the Durham Light Infantry. They were both keen, and the masters that were at school, Jim Sanderson was an ex-Durham Light Infantryman. One grew up in the atmosphere of serving one's country.
Was discipline then for you personally of the kind that you just took on board? It wasn't imposed, it was something that you automatically...
Yes, this is it. One respected old people and one expected respect from younger people. It was ingrained, I think. One grew up that way. I don't remember father raising his voice, but he must have done, obviously, with six boys. But I know, for instance, as we grew up, as each one of us reached the age of five, he took us to the sea and taught us to swim. And when we went, as we did every year on holiday, we used to, in those days, I can remember, the cab used to come, horse-drawn, and this was the big day when we all climbed on board, were taken, driven to the station, and another of father's friends was the station master, who wore a top hat and a very grave expression, and we were handed into our compartment to proceed down to, it was generally in the early days, Redcar, which was a very, very popular place and very clean.
Did you have an annual holiday?
Oh yes, always. One always went away.
Where did you go?
As when we were very young, we always used to go down to Redcar. We went to the same place every year, and we knew the people extremely well. It was a safe resort. Parents could keep an eye on us quite easily, and until we grew. Well, until I think we would go to Saltburn and possibly Scarborough once, but I can't now remember. But I do remember the year my father died, one expected holiday would go by the board. I had an uncle in Hull, and he had two of my brothers go down to spend 2 weeks of the summer holiday with him. Later on, we went further afield, obviously, and we bought a car in 1934, and was able to go, all over the country.
You say you left school... 16?
Yeah.
Had you to sit an examination before you left? Had you passed anything, qualified in any way at that point, 16?
No. The school cert was the year after. And
where did you go?
This is why I went to night classes. I went to the night classes, the local, county council classes at Bishop Auckland Grammar School, they were held. And I suppose part of the reason I took economics was that I expected to be in some sort of work all my life connected with figures and economics. And I also, of course, being in the surveyor's office at Bishop Auckland Council, took up building construction, continue with geometry, mathematics of all sorts.
Did you get your job immediately you left school?
Oh, yes. I
was this some kind of apprenticeship that you had to go through?
I had hoped when I went to Bishop Auckland Council that it was an apprenticeship, but I learned to my cost 4 years later that it hadn't been. And so, in disgust, I left the council and went to work for a firm of, they were mainly auctioneers, they did estate work and they did survey work.
In the council offices, you say it was a surveyor's office?
Yes.
What was your work?
Well, this will probably surprise you. In the town hall, there were only, in the surveyor's office, there was the surveyor and myself. In the sanitary inspector's office, there was the sanitary inspector by himself. In the accountant's office and rating office, there was the accountant, his chief clerk, his cashier, the market manager, who was also a rates and rent collector, and myself. And that was pretty well the, a typist, male typist. That was the council staff. But we had a part-time clerk of the council, E.B. Proud, who fitted any council work that he had to do in with his private practice. E.B. Proud and Son.
What work were you actually doing?
To start with, I was doing the payment of the workmen that we had, the keeping of the stores that the council carried, and I was then allowed to do certain amount of drawings, preparing them for the surveyor, and working drawings up. But you know, we had our own fire brigade, which the surveyor's department ran. And when there was a fire, one of my duties was to jump on a bicycle and cycle around to where I knew the men were working who were in the brigade. I must have learned something from the surveyor, because one day the Lord Bishop himself asked if a plan could be made of the palace. And the surveyor said, off you go and do this plan for the bishop. Well, in those days, I was a young man and still in great awe of the bishop. Of course, in Durham County, the bishop was the top man. I went along to see him, and I can see him now with his beetling brows, and he looked at me, and what he thought, he was very careful not to say, except, start where you wish. See my butler for anything you need. So I knew St. Alexander, the butler, so that was only too easy. And I started off, and the council got on perfectly well without me for 2 or 3 weeks, except that I had to go back and see to the wages and things of that nature. And I drew this plan on the best, in those days, local authorities used the best Wattman paper. It was almost like a type of handmade canvas, the most beautiful paper that you ever saw. And I did this plan for the bishop, took it round to him, and handed it after this had been vetted, of course, by the surveyor, took it round to him and handed it over in fear and trembling. He took it, he looked at it, he looked at me, he looked at it again, and he felt in his pocket, and he brought out a large wallet, and out of it he drew one of the things that you will never ever see, a large, white, crinkly £5 note. And he said, thank you very much, boy. Buy yourself a bicycle. The one I had I'd bought from one of the solicitor's clerks for 7 and 6 pence nearly 2 years before, and it truly was rather dilapidated, and I think the bishop must have observed it, because he was much, much more observant than a lot of people gave him credit for.
How many hours a day did you work?
9 till 12, and then 1 till 5, Monday till Friday, and then 9 till 12 on a Saturday. You get a fortnight's holiday in the summer, and 2 days, of course, at Easter, 2 days at Whitsuntide, 2 days at Christmas, and then 2 days at New Year. And I think one of the funniest things that happened the first year I was there, when the staff were talking about summer holidays, and I waited till they'd finished, and they looked at me. Logically, of course, I should have got my holiday somewhere about November. And I said, we normally go away the second and third weeks in August. So the, I suppose you would call him the chief executive now, said, in that case, Paul, you'd better have that.
What was your first wage?
My first wage was 10 shillings per week, rose within a year to 15 shillings a week, and then by the fourth year it was £1 a week.
Did you hand this over to your mother?
Yes. And I got slightly more than the one penny I'd been getting previously, but not a lot. I felt that I owed it to mother to give her as much as she could possibly need. I was then, the surveyor brought in a private pupil who was the nephew of one of our local councillors, and I realised that the future there wasn't for me. The wages were going to go up automatically at 0.5 crown a year, and that again wasn't for me. So one of my friends was the son of an estate agent, and so he said, why not come to us? We are very, very busy. And in spite of my mother's protestations, I went to work for him. It was an easy life. Selling houses in those days was absolutely child's play. The new houses in a place called Watling Road, or Hestabel Gardens, at the south of the town, were £350 each. Semi-detached houses, with a very nice garden front and back. And I sold regularly 2 a week, until the owner of the firm realised that he was paying money out which his son could have. So he put me on to work inside the, collecting wages, driving around to, collecting rents, driving around to places like South Church, Tyndall Crescent, even as far away as Wingate, Station Town, Shotton. And that cut down the number of houses that I could sell in a week, and I was rather disgruntled.
You got some kind of fee for selling the house, did you?
Yes, yes, we got a fee. Regrettably, I can't remember what. It's obviously on £365, it wouldn't be a lot. But he was paying me, I think, a quarter of what he got. It was so good that every now and again we used to have with my friends, my wealthy, I still kept my wealthy friends, and with these friends I used to have weekends to places like Amsterdam, Dieppe, all sorts of places just on the fringe of the continent.
Was this by air or sea?
Sea. There was no air traffic then. And the men's wages were, a workman, an ordinary labourer, was paid around this time, and it varied very, very little over a number of years, was 11 3/4 an hour. And they worked normally 47 hours a week. Sometimes they were given a little overtime, but not a lot. It was kept to the minimum. The tradesmen, people like joiners and the steamroller driver, Ben Ridley, and keeper of the recreation ground, Tom Eales, were paid 1/6 an hour. And then from my recollections, that stayed from 1930 until I left in 1934. It hadn't varied by a halfpenny.
Did you receive some form of training in the estate agency?
Yes, yes. I was training there to be, I was wanting to become a chartered surveyor. And you had to pass various exams. So during the time I was working there, I carried on the night classes I had been doing, which were, as I say, building construction, building science, various mathematics that were included, and as I say, for some extraordinary reason, I took economics as a pastime. And because it was at the girls' school, I took German. I don't really know why now, except that one regarded the Germans as our enemy, and I wanted to know something about them. It's very hard, it must be very, very, very deep from youth, when as a small boy I used to listen to my uncles talking about the battles. My youngest uncle, for instance, I remember, had scars across his body where he'd been wounded several times. He was a linesman, and I understand that the life of a linesman in the Great War was very short. I know the life of a signaller in our war wasn't very happy, partly because the equipment we had was poor and partly because the enemy looked for them. They were static targets.
Was this general within people that you know of, this dislike, hatred of the Germans after the First World War? Did that continue?
It must have been, because there were a number of us took German in those courses, and it was the only country that we never thought of going to visit. Mind, I must be honest, I still belong to the little Englander school, where the Cali is another world. I almost said the sort of thing I shouldn't say, but perhaps you'll guess what I was thinking. No, it must have been instilled into us from the First War, we that grew up during the war and afterwards. It must have been. I can think of nothing else. Because even our comics didn't have a lot to do with the German enemy, although a number of magazines and books one read and bought were slanted against the Germans. The Germans always lost, of course.
You were at your estate agents. Where did you go next?
Well, when I saw that I wasn't going to make much money there, I saw an advert in the paper saying that Railroads at Heaven were looking for designers, which meant you had to be a good draftsman. And luckily, I'm able to draw very quickly, and I'm ambidextrous, so I was able to draw with both hands. So I applied, asked for an interview. In my ignorance, I asked for an interview with the chief of the drawing office, a man called Frank Coates, and he saw me, to the surprise of the escorting gate man. Even then, I didn't know that one clocked in those days and clocked out and was timed for whatever functions one had to perform. And I went up to see Frankie Coates, and he saw me, and we talked, and he asked me what I could do, what I did, and then he made me an offer, and I laughed at him, stood up, and I said, "Well, sir, I'm sorry. I'm afraid I'm wasting yours, and I feel that I'm wasting mine." And he looked a bit surprised, and he said, "What would you come for?" I said, "Twice that on 6 months' trial. If I'm no use, fired at the end of 6 months." And he said, "We don't pay graduates that." And I said, "Well, sorry for the graduates." And but I thanked him profusely for seeing me and moved out. Drove back home and reported to the family that it was no use. However, the next day, a letter appeared saying, "Start Monday at your figure."
How much was the figure that you negotiated?
£3 a week. And interestingly enough, to run my car at that time, travelling 30 miles from Bishop Auckland to Hebburn and back each day, 6 days a week, and the pleasant evenings and running about that I had, it cost me precisely £2 a week to run the car for myself, and I, of course, include all my family, mother, and all friends that we took out. So in those days, life was very pleasant on £3 a week. However, at the end of 6 months, I marched up and heard nothing. So I marched up to see Mr. Coates and said, "Right, sir, I've served 6 months. Am I fired or am I satisfactory?" And he said, he looked at me a bit puzzled, forgotten all about this importunate boy, and at least young man. And he said, "Off you go." And the next week, there was another 10 shillings a week in my pay. For a while, I found it rather difficult because I was put into the department that dealt with the layout of control boards of power stations, the large power stations. For instance, the one I was on with was the Battersea Power Station. And I spent 6 weeks laying out a power station panel. When I took it to the chief, and he shook his head sadly and said, "Oh, Paul, I'm sorry. I forgot to tell you. The electric field has to be taken into consideration around the instruments." I said, "What does that mean?" He said, "Scrap that and start again." This was a bit disheartening. But when I'd finished that, 6 months later, there was a slack period for me, and so I was given a small, what do you call it? It was a switch block. I think that's the easiest way to describe it to you. And he said, "Have a look at that and see if you can reduce the components in it in any way without affecting its efficiency." So I thought, well, I'm rather ignorant of electric equipment anyhow, but I fiddled, I drew it out, I drew every angle, I drew it at all angles. I daren't tell you the number of times I drew it and tore it up. It must have run into hundreds. Until one, suddenly I looked at the switch and I looked at my drawing and I thought, there's something different here. So, took a deep breath, went up to the chief and said, "Have I managed something?" And he looked at it. "I've worked here 30 bloody years and you've done it in 6 months. And he sent it straight up to the design office. They checked it over and they found out that they were saving. This piece of equipment, of course, was manufactured in hundreds of thousands, and nothing was said to me except that the following Saturday there was another 10 shillings a week in my pay.
This sounds very complex work from what you'd been doing. Were you again in a training and learning situation?
Yes, I was learning up there. I was still doing design, doing night classes, but they were becoming more scientific, and I was going to go in, instead of surveying, I was going to go in for civil engineering. But by that time, 1938 had come up, and warning bells were ringing.